shed
unless we can be creating a real free press where the American people get different viewpoints other than those expressed in the establishment-controlled media, there's going to be a civil war in this country, and it's going to come soon.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. John Kerry turns up in Cairo with a check for $600 million as the military junta sentenced hundreds of democratically elected activists to death. So, is the United States sending the right message around the world about dictators? Hey-ho, and off we go. Al-Sisi's Egyptian junta have banned and sentenced to death hundreds of organisers in Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood who were democratically elected. The majority party, indeed. And they also jailed three Al Jazeera journalists for the heinous crime of telling the truth. In the same week, US Secretary of State John Kerry has released nearly $600 million to Al-Sisi for a job well done. So, is it time to say bye-bye to the United States, who are bankrolling the world's dictators and march them out of their UK bases? Plus, as our support for Syria rebels backfires into Iraq, the World Health Organization's quietly refused this week to publish the findings of its report into Iraqis' birth defects and other mutations. They've been caused by Britain and America's use of depleted uranium ammunition in 1991 and 2003 invasions that we've conducted. And I'll be joined a bit later by DU and Iraq expert Joe Baker. Also, we look at the so-called ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. What's been going on now Kiev and their separatists are out of the media spotlight? But I'm joined first by Lindis Percy from the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases. Hi, Lindis, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony.
First of all, you are, I believe, a campaign that's been going for around about a decade or so. Can you just tell us about how you first started and why?
I was a midwife in Southampton when we lived there and came across a notice on a pavement that said, come and hear about cruise missiles. So Christopher and I, my husband and I, went along to the meeting. It was put on by a trade union. And I was shocked to learn that nuclear weapons were coming to a base just near our home called RAF Greenham Common. I got involved there and soon learnt that actually it wasn't RAF. It was occupied and controlled by the American visiting forces.
Yeah, but the Americans have been here since World War II, Lindis, and in a way, we do sort of need them, don't you, as a kind of backup?
What do you mean, backup? when you start to look at this, Tony, it gets very complicated, and the bottom line is that there is no accountability of what they do here. There's no accountability to Parliament. They came here with no debate in Parliament, and they do what they like, whether it's lawful or not.
I mean, surely the realpolitik nowadays is that if you're going to survive, as we've seen with little countries like Ukraine, you know, well, even though that's quite a big country, you can't really be a little independent country anymore. You've got to align yourself with one of these big global power blocks.
Well, it's like sort of talking about making friends, isn't it? You know, sometimes you've got to be very critical of what friends do. And yes, there's the special relationship. There's a whole history of how the Americans came in to the Second World War, somewhat late, actually, in my view, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and came in because of vested interest, and again, in my view. And we've gone on for years and years and years really doing what the Americans want and following on the Americans' actions and policies and whatever. And it is, you know, it's not good that there is very little accountability, very little scrutiny, and that is what the Campaign for the Accountability of American Bases, CAB, does. We look at what they are doing. We bring public scrutiny and awareness to what the American visiting forces and their agencies are doing in this country. And, Tony, it's not good when you start to scratch the surface.
OK, give us an idea of the scale of the US presence in terms of bases and personnel in Britain.
Well, it's difficult to find out actually how many bases there are here. We think there's about 12. I say that because even the Pentagon doesn't know how many bases they have around the world. I mean, that's well documented. There are about 5,000, 6,000 American visiting forces here, but that doesn't count, you know, the number of agencies like the NSA, the CIA, the National Reconnaissance Office, and very dark forces involved too. It's very difficult to get information about some of these bases. I mean, we are particularly interested in Menwith Hill, which is about 8 miles from my home, near Harrogate in North Yorkshire. And it's very, it's a very secretive base. It puts all our security at risk, and yet there is no sort of accountability, no public scrutiny as to what they do. Questions that we ask in Parliament, because that's one of the things that the way we work in CAB is to make to ask questions, and a lot of them are refused. A lot of them are, you know, very sort of scantily answered, if at all, and it's very difficult to find out what they do. But we have, over the years, begun to sort of piece together the jigsaw of and the picture of what they're doing. That's just one base here. You know, there's all sorts of things going on with American bases in this country. For example, there's a base in Bedford, in Northamptonshire, called Croughton. Now, there are all American bases are called or referred to as RAF. Greenham Common was RAF. But actually, when you start to look at it, it's not RAF at all. It's USAF, the United States Air Force, or National Security Agency, National Reconnaissance Office at Menwith Hill, etc. But this base in Northampton called Croughton, USAF Croughton, is due for a massive expansion. How do we find this out? Sometimes it's just actually happening to stumble across this information. Because there's some information out there, you know. We need a full-time researcher on all this. But it's a huge development at Croughton, and Croughton is going to be on a par with this very secretive and unaccountable base called NRO Menwith Hill, which is the largest outside the states. Intelligence gathering and surveillance base. That is not the only thing they do.
Anyway, on Menwith Hill and Croughton, I can remember back in the 1980s, investigative journalist Duncan Campbell,
yes,
digging out stuff about what was going on up at Menwith Hill.
Yes.
And we weren't supposed to know anything about this. What they were doing, the US was actually listening into right across the BT phone networks to everybody's phone calls that they felt like it.
Yes.
And they were using Menwith Hill to get around the law. So if the British wanted to spy on someone but they didn't want to go to the courts to do it, they would get the Americans to do it for them, and then they would listen maybe to the conversation saying, well, look, we didn't do this, the Americans spied on this.
Yes, that's right, and it's all sort of secretive and all that.
So what's been the revelations from Edward Snowden? Because he was talking about all this kind of thing, the extent to which everything we do and see on the internet, the things we talk about on the telephone, this kind of thing is being intercepted. And I mean, I just wonder how you feel the Snowden revelations a year or so ago have affected what we know about what the Americans are up to.
I first want to say that I think Edward Snowden is such a brilliant whistleblower, and at what cost. He has done such a service to the world in terms of revealing, exposing, you know, thousands of documents which were published by The Guardian and Washington Post. And it is such a marvellous, wonderful thing that he's done. And amongst these documents, Menwith Hill is mentioned quite a few times. I mean, it's an extremely important intelligence hub. And yet, Parliament doesn't know what they do. They always have said that the Intelligence and Security Committee have oversight of this base and all other US bases. Absolute nonsense. The Home Affairs Committee, not so long ago, said that, you know, they are not fit for purpose.
So is what Duncan Campbell said back in the 1980s, calling Britain an unsinkable aircraft carrier, almost like Orwell's Airstrip 1, is that actually true? Do the Americans do exactly what they want here?
Pretty much.
And what are they actually doing up at Minwith Hill? What do we know now from Snowden and other revelations about what they do? Because I imagine, Lindis, you probably know more than a lot of MPs, a lot of parliamentarians do about what's happening there.
We do, Tony. I think we do, and certainly we know more than the Ministry of Defence Police, who work on the base. I mean, I've recently made, I've said to them, I've reported crimes to them, to the Ministry of Defence, that they are protecting unlawful activities in the light of Edward Snowden.
Okay, what specifically, though?
What specifically? Well, what Edward Snowden revealed in the documents revealed was that they can tap into and do any airborne communications. Now, we knew that they did, Tony. We knew about the Echelon system, which was a system, it's called Five Eyes, because there are five countries who signed up to this.
Well, that should be Ten Eyes, shouldn't it?
Ten Eyes?
Well, if you've got five countries then, or five people, they've got ten eyes. So they're almost talking about countries as one-eyed monsters.
Yes, indeed. I think that's absolutely right. I think what Edward Snowden has revealed is the massive extent of the surveillance and tapping into all our private phone calls, emails, fax. Do people use fax anymore? But mobile phones, and it is a huge assault on privacy laws here, and yet the government is silent on it. There is a review by RUSI, actually, going on, looking at really domestic surveillance.
And that's the Royal United Services Institute.
It is, yes, and I was looking at the panel, how the panel was made up the other night, and it is deeply concerning, really, because they're pretty much, as far as I can see, establishment figures. You know, establishment figures. I mean, maybe they've done good things, but I think that doesn't sound very independent, this review. And also, they say it's independent of government, but it doesn't sound as if the people on the panel are very independent, frankly. Yeah.
One of the big bases that the US has got in Britain is Fairford. That's in Gloucestershire, quite near here. I remember reading a couple of years ago that the Americans were thinking of closing it down because they're running out of money and they're spreading their armed forces a bit thinly. They keep sort of taking over new bits of the world. They want to put those forces there. So the Americans still, is Fairford still going to be a big base for the Americans?
Well, interesting that you should mention Fairford, USAF Fairford, because recently two stealth bombers and two B-52s arrived at Stelford. I think they've gone probably now. They say that, you know, they were there for exercises, but you wonder about, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in Iraq, because when we went into the illegal war in Iraq, eight B-52s arrived at Fairford. This was in 2003, and they went on to Guam and to bomb from thousands and thousands and thousands of feet up people in Iraq.
Okay.
I just thought of this, that actually Fairford is usually in mothballs, but then they can activate it within, I think it's 3 days, something like that. And the stealth bomber and B-52s just slipped into Fairford.
Okay, so what's the number of your argument in the Campaign for Accountability? What is your objection to the US being here, apart from the surveillance? You're also saying that the Parliament doesn't have proper oversight. What would you be saying to an American if you were discussing requesting them to leave? Why should they do that?
I think I would say to them, do you know what really goes on these bases? I mean, the American people, generally, I understand, don't know what goes on. They don't know how much money is spent. When you think of the poverty in the States and the amount of money that's spent on bases and military and arms around the world, that the Americans are still investing in. I mean, the thing is that we could talk about the Middle East and the mess of what's going on in Iraq and Syria. But the people who benefit from that are the arms trades. They make very good profit out of all this conflict. And I'd say to an American, please start to ask questions of what your government is doing, what your military is doing. It is very difficult, as I said before, to get information, but start to chip away at what your president is doing. I mean, he got the Nobel Peace Prize, didn't he? Which is absolutely outrageous when you think of the conflict that he's causing around the world.
Okay, well, I'm also joined in the studio by Joanne Baker. Joanne has written a book called Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq War. Hi, Joanne, welcome to the Politics
right,
Show.
Hello.
Now, we were just discussing with Lindis there a bit about the mess that's been made of Iraq. Tell us what your concerns are this week, because I know you have some particular things you want to say, and I know also the World Health Organization has spent hundreds of thousands, even and or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds on this report, dollars on this report on the effects of depleted uranium in Iraq, and now it's saying, well, we're going to keep it secret.
Yes, thank you, Tony. I'd really just like to go back to something Linda said as well, because I feel that the British establishment do collude enormously with the Americans, and that, like in America, we have an overground foreign policy and an underground foreign policy, and that our intelligence services and SAS and SBS are very involved in what the Americans are up to globally. And I also remember from Iraq during the sanctions and when the UN were complaining about the no-fly zones and all the trouble they were causing. They were also very illegal, that they found that actually the hardest line was in London rather than Washington. So I do think we have an equal problem in this country with our establishment. And what's going on in Iraq at the moment, I think that the media has suddenly jumped on board because they've heard the word ISIS. And those who've been watching Syria closely just know how vicious and ferocious and, you know, what bad news ISIS is. But what the part of the story that hasn't been told is that the Iraqi revolution really has been going on for several years inside Iraq, to at least over 2 years of peaceful protest, mass demonstrations, all completely ignored by the Western media. And then since Christmas, the Maliki government has been just bombing Western Iraq non-stop. Towns like Fallujah and Ramadi, there's been 500,000 displaced, many, many civilian casualties, many women, many children. And if we think of the problem of some of these towns, Fallujah particularly, where there's been an extraordinary sort of rise in birth defects and cancers and all kinds of very complex health problems amongst children there. And Fallujah Hospital has been bombed continually, you know, in the last few months. Most of the medics have fled. There's just a few very brave left who are taking in the immediate casualties. And every day there's women and children brought in. And War Child has also just produced a report. They're saying on average, three Iraqi children are killed every other day, and many more wounded. So this is a problem that has been going on for a long time. You know, it seems to be a shock to people that big cities like Mosul have suddenly fallen. But we have to remember that ISIS is actually only a small part of this. There's many, many armed groups, mainly the tribes in Western Iraq. And this has been really well organized, coordinated over a long period of time. Many of the old Iraqi army under the Ba'ath are involved, and they're trying to have a revolution, but they want a unified Iraq. They are asking for a place in the political system, and they see the Maliki government as just a continuation of the American occupation, that it has done absolutely nothing for the people. I mean, all these years later, the people of Iraq, including the poor Shias as well, there's no electricity, hardly any potable water, mass unemployment, no healthcare, an appalling education system, nothing none of the money that is now flowing from the oil, and it is flowing into the Iraqi population, is flowing into Western oil companies. BP and Shell are doing nicely, and into the pockets of a very few corrupt leaders inside Iraq.
Well, one of the positive things we can say is that we did have the biggest demonstration the world has ever seen in order to try and stop the 2003 invasion, even though it didn't really work. And also, there is the Chilcot inquiry, which was at least some people's positive attempt to find out the collusion, the criminal collusion between the United States and Britain. And it's interesting to hear you saying that Britain was in some ways taking a harder line than the Americans were. So what are your thoughts, Joe, about the failure, really? I mean, we've had the failure to publish this World Health Organization report about the effects of the war, but we've also had a failure to publish the report on the reasons for going to war. And that does tend to make you think that, well, maybe there's evidence in that Chilcot report which could bring Bush and Blair and others who are involved bring them into the dock and actually get them put behind bars.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have a big problem with international law and with the UN in general. I mean, I think there's many, many people all over the world who see what's happened to Iraq as the most abominable crime. But it's actually being able to push it far enough so that we can get these people into court.
I mean, my heart goes out to the Iraqis. I can remember back in 2003, the Arab League saying that if the Americans and the British go ahead with this attack, it could open up the gates of hell in Iraq, and it seems that has unfortunately has come true. What were your thoughts about all this stuff, Lindis? Because it does seem that there is a very, very close relationship between the US and the UK on this, and it's going to be almost impossible to pull the two apart, because in a way they're kind of criminal co-conspirators, and it's very difficult to get them to prize one from the other, because they will naturally want to stick together, both being criminal in a criminal conspiracy.
I think it's just horrific. I really do, and it's shocking and it's shameful and all the rest of it. I mean, I've got a dear friend whose son, Matt, was killed in Iraq in 2006. And for what? It was just awful. And it is such a mess, as I said before. And really, politicians in government aren't asking those penetrating questions about what on earth are we doing? I mean, Haig's out there at the moment, isn't he, in Iraq, asking questions. What are we doing there? What are the Americans doing there? You know, we can send humanitarian aid and to Syria and work towards, if we're asked, actually, you know, we shouldn't be meddling in all this. We've caused too many problems. I was a midwife before, as I say, and I am horrified, Joe, hello Joe, by what happened in Fallujah. And nobody seems to be particularly bothered. I mean, Joe obviously is, and there are other people who are. But when you're talking about, you know, the rich and powerful and the people who could make a difference, they don't seem to be bothered at all. When I heard about that report about Fallujah, I went up to Menwith Hill, and I'd put some notices out, and I just scattered these notices all over the car park, and I just was quite amazed at my own anger, actually, about it. And there were some American soldiers watching, and I just fired off about it.
Well, I mean, you say, Linda, about it being a mess, and I think you've said the same sort of thing, Joe, but I mean, do you think, both of you, maybe that this is absolutely deliberate, that a mess is exactly what they wanted to create, because then they can just go in, take the oil, and also, when it comes to the time that they want to, they can sort out that mess in exactly whichever way they want. It's a kind of disaster capitalism, where the capitalists come in, and then they can just create whatever they want out of the chaos.
Yes, I do think it is, and this has been called in Israel creative chaos. And actually, if you look what's happened in the last 10 years, the number of countries, you know, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Ukraine now, Sudan and Somalia, you know, Mali, how many are being pushed over the edge into this incredible sectarian and appalling state, which is not the fault of the people themselves. It's absolutely contrived.
Okay, Lindis, before we say goodbye to you, I know it's going to be Independence from America Day, isn't it, next week? Can you just tell us a bit about what you plan to organise for that?
It is indeed. As you know, the Americans celebrate Independence Day, and it's a great, great day. Since 1980, we've had independence from America at the American base at Menwith Hill, run by the NSA and NRO. And it's on July the 4th, 5 to 9. Do hope people are going to come. We've got some very interesting speakers like Annie Mason, who was the whistleblower, GCHQ. Very interesting woman who has a lot to say about GCHQ's security services and the role of the NSA. David Swanson from the States, who's very, very interesting too, coming specially over, who's author, activist, journalist, has a radio program too, and also the newly appointed professor of conflict resolution and peace at Bradford Department of Peace Studies. So lots of music too, so it'd be really good if people came along. We need to actually give a lot of attention to this base and other US bases in this country. CAB's not only concerned with bases in this country, but worldwide, actually. We've got lots of contacts with similar struggles around the world, and we've got a huge task on.
Okay, it's Friday the 4th of July, next Friday, that's all happening. But Lindis, well, how do people come across you? Can people join your campaign, or is it something which is just on the internet?
We don't have membership, actually, but we have a website, www.caab.org.uk. We're on Twitter and Facebook, and the contact numbers or contact details are on the website. So if people want to come along or want to find out what's going on, please get in touch with us.
Okay, Lindis Percy from North Yorkshire. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. And we carry on with Joe Baker. Now, Joe, what about this report, from the World Health Organization? What exactly were they looking into? And I may imagine, because you know quite a lot about this, what do you think may have been in that report that they've refused to publish?
Well, this is interesting, because this report was actually finished 2 years ago, in 2012, and it still hasn't been published. At the time, actually, the BBC interviewed some ministers within the Iraqi government who co-sponsored the report, and they were kind of leaking at the time that the report did show a very definite evidence between the towns and places that had been heavily shelled by the Americans and this great surge of bird deformities.
So tell us a bit about depleted uranium. How does this stuff come about? I mean, is it just from nuclear reactors like the one they're planning to build at Hinkley?
Yes, it is a nuclear waste, and it's interesting because depleted uranium is the uranium left over during the initial enrichment process, which has less uranium 235, in which is the one they use for fission, but it's got a great deal of U-238. And that has been, it's a very dense metal that is pyrophoric, and they find that it was used initially as an anti-tank weapon when they wanted.
When you say pyrophoric, what does that mean?
It means it spontaneously ignites and it burns at very, very high temperatures. So if you want an inferno, it's a great metal to use.
Okay, so it really is a sort of byproduct. This is the thing that amazes me about things like this: is somebody somewhere would normally have to be paid quite a lot of money to safely dispose of that nuclear waste.
Yeah,
instead, it's handed over to the military, and I imagine they pay for these things. It's a way of turning what should be carefully looked after waste into some kind of product that you can then sell and fire at foreigners.
Yeah, and this story gets even more complicated because actually in Fallujah they haven't found depleted uranium, and the same in Lebanon, parts of Afghanistan. They're finding something different, which is a very low enriched uranium, and this is a big mystery. It's a complete mystery to people. It's often found in bomb craters, so it's looking as if a different form of uranium metal is being used, maybe in warheads, or we really don't know. There's just lots and lots of questions around it, but it's being found everywhere these days.
Okay, on the general situation in Iraq, I mean, obviously quite a lot of these ISIS fighters we've heard about the last few weeks, they seem to be a group that were armed by the Saudis. Obviously, most of the money for the Saudis comes from this part of the world, and with the blessing of Britain and the United States, and yet now they've become the enemy. So I wonder to what extent you think that there is a deliberate attempt to just use these jihadis who are sort of fired up with the Quran and this kind of thing to just destabilise the entire region.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And this is history, isn't it? Because Al-Qaeda came about in Afghanistan when the US and UK wanted some very fierce fighters to fight the Soviets. So, you know, that's when they were born. And I think it's interesting that ISIS has been trained by the US recently in Camp Jordan. And so these fighters are going in, and at the same time the US is selling vast amounts of weaponry to the Maliki government. So really they're absolutely arming both sides again.
Okay, so your book is Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq War. But I know you're also part of a couple of groups and you've got some activities this weekend that you're planning.
Yes, I'm from Child Victims of War, and we have a sponsor walk in Bristol starting at the Arnold Feeney on Sunday the 29th at 11 o'clock. And
that's this Sunday.
Yeah, this Sunday, yes. And we're going to walk, it's a lovely walk, it's up the river to Ashton Court, have a picnic over the suspension bridge and back down to the docks again. Children and dogs are welcome, and all the money that we raise is going to go to an incredible organisation in Kabul, actually in Afghanistan, which runs projects for women and children.
Okay, just remind us again what time that starts.
11 o'clock outside the Arnold Feeney,
okay,
Sunday.
So people can come and meet you there, yeah, and have a wander down if they want to.
And children and dogs are welcome. So,
and where can people follow Child Victims of War and your other work on the internet?
Yeah, we have a website which is childvictimsofwar.org.uk.
Okay, Joanne Baker, another fascinating explanation of what's going on in Iraq, which you're not going to get anywhere else. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Okay, thank you.
from 1991. There's Bristol Roofer there, Gary Clale on New Sound System with Human Nature. And I'm joined in the studio now by Hilary Saunders and Steve Timmins from Protect Our NHS, or People for People, Not Profit. Hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
First, what's all this argument you've been having with the CCG, that's the Clinical Commissioning Group, about public involvement, Steve?
Well, the argument has been going on for some time because we, as you know, there have been huge changes to the NHS, and we felt it was very important that the public were involved with any of the changes. It's, after all, it's our NHS. We're all potential patients. And we realised that the Clinical Commissioning Group in Bristol did not have a proper lawful set of arrangements in their policy for involving the public. And that's all we wanted them to do. And we struggled to get a response.
Okay. Who are these people, the Clinical Commissioning Group?
They are the people who've taken over from the primary care trusts. And as people, they are a group of GPs, who are the people who sit on the governing body or board, who help make the decisions. And then there are permanent officers on there who are, in effect, civil servants.
Okay. And what about publicly accountable? I mean, can you go along to these meetings, watch them make their deliberations? And most importantly, I suppose, are their outside interests? Are they listed and publicly available too?
All their outside interests are listed, although we have, of course, found some strange anomalies down in North Somerset. But in Bristol, there has been no issue about any conflicts of interest. And yes, you can attend their meetings. They have a public question session at the beginning of each monthly meeting, which is held on at 1:30 on a Tuesday in the month. So it's difficult for a lot of people working to get there. And you can ask questions. They ask you to put them in writing first. And then after a while, you can listen to some of the deliberations, and then they hold stuff in private session. And we don't know what happens in there.
So, Hilary, have you managed to get any changes? Have you managed to get some sort of clarity about whether the public can get involved and how they can get involved?
Yes, we've just obtained a court order which has required the CCG to put in place arrangements for public involvement, and that's meant changing their constitution and their policies. So we're very pleased with that.
Well, that's okay for Bristol, but what about other parts of the country? I mean, it seems a bit naughty of the government to set this thing up without the proper procedures for public to be aware of what they're doing, because after all, they're our servants on this CCG.
It is actually a legal requirement.
So they didn't do it.
They didn't do it, and they argued about it for several months, which is why we threatened them with legal action. And what we've got now is a by consent order, which we're very pleased with, but in many ways it would have been better to have a legal precedent by having an actual court hearing, because then it would actually have applied right across the country.
Okay, so what practical difference has it actually made, getting this court order? What will it force them to now do that they wouldn't have done before?
They simply have to put proper arrangements in place so that anybody, a patient or a member of the public, knows how they can get involved in the CCG's decision.
Steve, give us an idea of the qualitative change that there's been between the old primary care trusts and this new CCG's system. I mean, it's a big question, but it's difficult to get your head around. Yeah. Exactly how has it changed, and what practically is going to change because of the CCG taking over?
The real difference is, on a national level, the Secretary of State doesn't have the responsibility anymore to impose his will on them. And the worst thing that's happened in locally is that they all operate independently. I mean, the National Health Service has been, if you like, atomised. I mean, each individual group has a responsibility for commissioning its own services, and it's very difficult. I mean, it's almost impossible to work out the lines of reporting, because there is involvement with the local authority through the health oversight scrutiny panels and with the health and wellbeing boards. There's a reporting to the Department of Health and the Secretary of State, there's NHS England, and then there are other things called the commissioning support units. And no one really understands what on earth is happening. And that's been a massive problem for everyone, because with the 20 billion of cutbacks in the NHS, services are going to be affected and are being affected and are changing. And people have the right to know where these services are going to be.
I think one of the crucial differences is that the NHS now comes under EU competition law. And what that means is that if the CCG does not grant a contract to a private health company, that company may decide to sue them under competition law. And so it's now all about competition instead of all about the care of patients.
I mean, practically, what difference does that mean on the ground, though? Because even for an ordinary patient, they don't really mind who's treating them, so long as someone is. And if someone can come along and do it cheaper than the old NHS could do, surely that's a good thing.
I think the basic thing there is that every private company has to make a profit. And therefore, if you've got a fixed budget, as the NHS has, and you're giving contracts to private companies, they have to make enough profit to pay their shareholders, and that means less money for the patients.
Okay, we heard last week on this show about closure of lots of GP clinics around the country. I think it's something like 100 threatened with closure. Also, massive deficits in NHS budgets right across the country, ready for the election year next year. Now, what do you know about how that's affecting us in this area?
The number of GP practices which are closing is because of the kind of arcane rules that they've brought into place. It's the smaller practices, because they're not generating enough revenue, because they get paid a certain amount of money per patient, and the smaller ones are just not getting enough money. And in Western Supermare, for instance, I mean, quite local to here, that's caused a big problem, and there are, I believe, still 300 patients who are not being covered by a GP surgery because of these changes. So in terms of that, the GP practices, it's going to be an increasing problem. A lot of them are looking at amalgamating. That's the other thing, because, as you know, they're independent practitioners. They run their own little businesses, and you may have already been aware that Virgin Care is taking over groups of GPs. So you're going to end up quite likely with much larger practices run by private companies, and that's not a good thing, for the same reasons as Hillary just said. They're all going to try and make a profit.
Okay, what about the deficits, though? Because we hear that a lot of the trusts are now running into deficits here in Bristol. We've got two big trusts. We've got the University Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust in the city centre. We've also got North Bristol NHS Trust, both coincidentally chaired by merchant venturers. John Savage chairing the Central Bristol one, and I think it's Peter Rillett chairing the North Bristol Trust. Also, a bit of an incestuous relationship with the City Council, in that the guy that sorted out the finance deal, the PFI for North Bristol, the brand new hospital at Southmead, has just popped up. He's now Chief Legal Officer at Bristol City Council. Unfortunately, I would like to see, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this, if someone is going to put together a finance deal for an NHS trust, that they see it through. But they don't leave just before the thing kicks in.
Yeah, but you mentioned PFI, the dread word, PFI. I mean, the first PFI in a health service came in 2000, was welcomed by Tony Blair, and that was, I think, North Cumbria University Hospital Trust. And that hospital had been built at the cost of £67 million. Over the 30-year period that the private company takes its money back, its profit, if you like, it'll cost the taxpayer £165 million. And that's the problem. I mean, no one's going to stay there for 30 years to watch the PFI out. It's an absolute... I mean, PFIs are a disaster. I mean, it was started under the Major government, taken up in spades by New Labour, and it's being carried on now by George Osborne. It's just, if they could stop the PFIs, their deficits would disappear. They're completely artificial.
I think that's a classic example of how private finance actually ends up costing you more in the NHS. You know, when hospitals were publicly funded, they didn't have these terrible mortgage deals.
Also, to what extent is the NHS actually being privatised? I mean, the government will say, no, it's not actually being privatised, because all of the spending is all still controlled, public money is all still controlled by arm's length groups, basically little quangos, which these CCGs are. Can I just get both of your views on whether it's really is privatisation or not?
About 70% of the contracts that have been awarded by CCGs during the last year have gone to non-NHS providers. And basically, if we keep doing that, we won't have an NHS in 5 years' time.
How long do these contracts normally run for, though? So, you know, if we're talking about how long will it be? So you're saying 5 years' time, that almost all those contracts now, then, by that time, will be with outside providers and not with NHS?
It's certainly possible. I mean, if you look at one example, which is rather close to home, it's a company called Care UK. Care UK started off as being Harmony, which was the Harrow out-of-hours doctor service, and then they bought up various other businesses, and it became Care UK. Care UK is now owned by a private equity company called Bridgepoint, and Bridgepoint used to be NatWest Capital Ventures. And Bridgepoint owns a large number of health companies. Care UK doesn't pay tax in this country. It's all offshore. KUK also owns Emerson's Green Independent Treatment Centre. Now, it's a block contract. It's a five-year block contract. And during the first 2 years, because people weren't using it and GPs weren't referring, in 2012 to 2014, KUK took £6 million in profits into their back pockets for doing nothing.
Also, I seem to remember that Chris Patton, who up until recently was the chairman of the BBC, he was part of this Bridgepoint organisation. I'm not sure he was an investor in it.
No, I think he's on the European Advisory Board.
So if you're wondering why the BBC didn't cover this as much as they ought to, maybe there were some senior managers who were a little bit afraid of getting their knuckles wrapped by Chris Patton exposing the BBC chairman as being wrapped up with it all. Hilary, how do you think the way that these changes have been brought in has been explained? And do you think that there's been any kind of proper consultation with the public about how things have been moved over, or has it just been imposed on us?
I think the changes have come through by deceit. The government, or at least David Cameron, said that he wasn't going to privatise the NHS. He said that he was going to pay off the deficit but not cut NHS funds. And as a result of not including any allowance for inflation, the NHS has actually had to make savings of £20 billion already, and they will be expected to make another £30 billion of savings. And how can you expect to have a decent health service if you starve it of funds? That is what this government is doing.
Now, you as a group, Protect Our NHS, are doing these legal challenges, but what can we do? I mean, obviously, people may feel that they want to be part of what you're doing, but what can most people, ordinary people, do in order to affect the way change is happening? Is there anything?
Well, I think everybody should tell their GP that they don't want private services being associated with their practice. I mean, I went down to have an asthma check, and I was amazed to find that I was being treated by a private company, which I made my feelings rather clear about that. I think everybody has to take responsibility for the fact that it's our NHS service. I mean, an Aaron Bevan, who brought it in, said it'll only last as long as there are people prepared to fight for it. And fighting for it doesn't have to mean you have to go out campaigning or giving leaflets out to people on the streets, which is what we do, and going around to houses. It means just think about what's happening. Try and get your GP to understand we don't want to be part of a privatised health system.
But Hilary, what gives you, Protect Our NHS, the right to speak for the public?
I think somebody has to stand up for the NHS. And that's basically because there's been very little media coverage about services being privatised in the NHS. We really need people to recognise that when you see the NHS logo, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's our National Health Service. Quite often, that's just standing in front of a service that's being provided by a private company now. People need to recognise that the NHS is being changed, and it could be irreversible if we don't stop it quickly.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I think, you know, you feel pretty strongly about this. You're also very much aware that the NHS was created after World War II, when people were very much fresh in their minds was the idea that you shouldn't really be checking somebody's bank balance before you decide whether you're going to help them out of a bombed building. And I wonder what your thoughts are about how irrevocable the changes that this coalition government have made to the health service, breaking their promises, of course, before the election.
Well, as Hilary pointed out, these new structures are actually open to EU competition law, and they knew that before they set off, that the EU rules are, as long as you've got a national health service, then competition law doesn't apply. So bringing this in by the back door allows competition law to operate. And therefore, if ultimately what we've got is a beautiful aquarium which is going to turn into fish soup, and they'll say, how do we get the aquarium back? And the answer is, you can't. The Commonwealth Institute in the US, which is actually a US-based organisation, recently did a comparative study of health systems across the world, and the NHS came out by far the most effective system, both in terms of outcomes and in terms of expenditure. But this has always been a problem for the free market, right? They've hated the whole concept of it, but as has been pointed out, David Cameron, before he was elected, said there were going to be no top-down reorganisation of the health service. That's exactly what he's done. this is all sleight of hand, and they're hoping that by the time they're kicked out, the damage will be done.
Well, I'd like to ask all three of you, one by one, what do you think can be done to stop this? Because clearly this is one of the most important things that we can hand on to future generations, and it's being chopped to pieces. Martin?
Well, obviously, talk to GPs by all means, but also vote against anybody who's ignorant in favour of these policies. They've got to feel the heat.
Well, I mean, hang on a minute, because the Labour, under New Labour, Martin, which is the party you're in, were complicit in all of this. We've just heard about the PFIs, and taking the first steps towards privatisation when they were in power.
They were indeed, and that's that they opened the door.
There isn't anyone to vote for, is there?
Well, but everybody who is standing for election, whatever party, and that includes Labour, they should be put under pressure. I mean, for example, the pressure you put on Labour candidates is, what are you going to do to reverse this? Because that puts them on the spot.
Andy Burnham has actually said that if Labour is elected, then they will reverse two key parts of the Health and Social Care Act. And the first one is the bit that takes away the responsibility from the health secretary to provide a comprehensive national health service. And the other bit is the clause that says that CCGs have to consider any qualified provider. And that would make a big difference, because it would stop the privatisation. Our concern would be whether there are still a lot of Blairites within the Labour Party who might put pressure on Andy Burnham and Ed Miliband not to go as far as they've said. But what I think is really interesting is that if you look at Scotland right now, Scotland has already reversed the privatisation that was involved in bringing in foundation trusts. And Alex Salmond has pledged that Scotland will have a national health service which is not privatised. And it's not actually doing him any harm. He's getting more and more votes. And I think what we have to do is to make sure that retaining a public national health service is a key issue at the next election, and politicians should realise that if they're going to vote for continuing privatisation, they will not have public support.
Steve, what are your thoughts?
I think that the 2012 Health and Social Care Act was pushed through Parliament, and 200 members of the MPs and Lords have private healthcare connections, and they all voted it through, and shame on them for doing it. I do think there is probably only one party that one can vote for, and I think we'll probably all do it slightly reluctantly, and that is Labour. I do think, having seen Andy Burnham say it now on three occasions, that they will do that. The final little thing, which is a bit off the wall, is there is a thing called the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. This, if this goes through, it's a European wide thing. If it goes through, then we will be open to every giant American insurance company to come in here and ruin our health system.
Okay, Hilary and Steve, thanks very much for joining us. Maybe you could just tell us finally how people stay in touch with you, get in touch with you, or even phone you if they're not on the internet.
They can certainly phone us. My number is 07841 238 588, 07841 238 588, and our website is www.protectournhs.wordpress.com, and there's lots of information about all these private companies and all the activities we do on there.
Okay, Hilary Saunders and Steve Timmins from Protect Our NHS, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, Egypt is calling for a national strike over Morsi decree. Now, that was actually in November 2012, a couple of years ago. And this is the thing that shocked me, really, about the decisions made this week in the Egyptian courts about the three Al Jazeera journalists going down for 7 years, hundreds of death sentences handed out to the Muslim Brotherhood. And yet, 2 years ago, it was these very judges who've sent these people down who were going against Morsi, who was the democratically elected president. So it seems this is really all about the judiciary. And in a way, the outcry against these awful decisions by the courts in Egypt is really an endorsement of the Muslim Brotherhood and an endorsement of Morsi.
Well, the situation is complicated. There's lots of opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, as well as a lot of support.
But they did win the election, even if it was just by a whisker. They should be the government.
Indeed, and Assad won the election in Syria last week or the week before. But, of course, what Britain is saying is that people should fight Assad. bomb Assad, kill Assad, car bombs, shootings. And of course,
but
the answer
that was last month, wasn't it?
But the answer for the Muslim Brotherhood, this is not what the Muslim Brotherhood are saying, but if what Britain's policy to Syria is to be taken as a guide, then the car bombs have got to come out, and the shooting's got to begin. And that includes the allies of the military dictatorship in Egypt, which means British diplomats, etc.
And what about...
And if we're up for war in Syria, we're up for war.
OK, what about John Kerry's $600 million he's handed over to the regime this week? What does that tell us about the Americans? I mean, it seems like all they're interested in doing is supporting dictators around the world.
Well, they support the dictators they want to support, and they oppose the ones they want to oppose. They supported an armed uprising in Syria. If they get an armed uprising in Egypt, they'll have nobody to blame but themselves.
OK, that's all for now. Time to sign off. The Murdoch News at 7. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour. That's Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston, Tim Lehman. Thanks also to Joe Baker, Hilary Saunders and Steve Timmins. We'll be with you next week. I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. Have a great weekend.
BCFM is an award.